The National Broadcasting Company presents Lives of Great Men, a new series on great leaders in human progress presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of The New Humanism and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs is building a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influences his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss Lee, the American warrior. We present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friends, the cleavage of political philosophy that took shape in the parties led by Jefferson and Hamilton culminated in the Civil War. The outstanding leaders in the fratricidal conflict were Lee and Lincoln, both nature's noblemen, each absolutely consecrated to his cause. The Union of States was formed under the whip of necessity, but the federal government grew rapidly in power and authority. Free trade and intercourse among the states lessened their importance. The vast tide of immigration came to America, not to a state government. Rapidly developing industries north and west further lessened the importance of state divisions. These causes did not act equally south. Virginia particularly had an agricultural population, English in descent, largely born upon the soil. Virginia had taken a leading part in the Revolution, sending the great commander to carry the struggle to victory. She had been the mother of presidents, and the original state patriotism continued in Virginia with peculiar warmth. All this was behind Robert E. Lee. Born in 1807, he was a son of Light Horse Harry Lee, beloved young comrade of Washington. The father died when Robert was 11, just as Washington had suffered, and Lee became the mainstay of his frail mother. Well prepared in schooling, Lee entered West Point at 18. We are told that Mrs. Lewis, the Nellie Custis of Mount Vernon and aunt of the girl Lee married, accompanied Lee to Washington to win General Andrew Jackson's help in securing the appointment. His brilliant West Point record enabled Lee to enter the Engineers. While at his first assignment at Hampton Roads, he frequently visited Arlington, beautiful home of Park Custis, Washington's step-grandchild and adopted heir. A tender love quickly developed with Mary Park Custis, daughter of the family, resulting in marriage when Lee was 24. This added a further bond to the numerous ones connecting his family with that of Washington. Very early, Lee had chosen Washington as his hero and model, and it is remarkable how many of the same qualities were in both. Lee had Washington's integrity of character and obedience to duty. Repeatedly, Lee said that duty was the noblest word in the language, and he made it the guiding principle of his conduct. He had also Washington's patient endurance, self-control, and fine modesty. Moreover, at the crisis of his career, Lee sought to achieve for his state and section that freedom from what he regarded as external tyranny Washington had won for the whole group of colonies. Lee's family life was happy and loyal. 7 children grew up to maturity, 3 sons becoming officers in the Confederate Army, 2 reaching the rank of Major General. A few months after Lee's marriage, the Nat Turner Rebellion occurred, an uprising of slaves in which 57 whites were murdered. It wakened the Southern people to the slumbering volcano on which they were living and stopped the wide movement for gradually emancipating the slaves. After service at St. Louis and New York, Lee's great training for his later career came in the war with Mexico. Appointed on General Scott's personal staff, he had much of the difficult work of advance. At Contreras, approaching Mexico City, the road lay between impassable lakes and morasses on one side, and on the other a tangled mass of lava rock called the Pedregal. Lee found a mule track through the Pedregal, widened it, and led 2 divisions forward. Then General Scott had to be notified, and alone at night in a blinding storm, Lee made his way back through the tangled rock, reported at 11 o'clock, and returned to the front in time for the morning assault. General Scott reported this act as the greatest feat of physical and moral courage performed by any individual to my knowledge pending the campaign. After the Mexican War, Lee served 4 years as superintendent of West Point and was then sent to Texas as colonel in command of a cavalry regiment newly formed by Jefferson Davis, United States Secretary of War. In 1859, Lee was called to Arlington by the death of his father-in-law. While he was at home, the John Brown raid at Harper's Ferry occurred, and the Secretary of War wired Lee to take a detachment of Marines, proceed to Harper's Ferry, and arrest the raiders. strange that task should have fallen to him. He resumed work in Texas, but in the spring of 1861 was summoned to Washington. He arrived to find 7 states already seceded and the Southern Confederacy an accomplished fact, with Jefferson Davis, ex-United States Secretary of War, its president. The war between the states was simply the culmination of that cleavage of political philosophy which began in the Constitution and took shape in the parties led by Jefferson and Hamilton. The original division was not sectional, and New England first challenged the federal government's authority. In the War of 1812, Daniel Webster, later the defender of the Union, in a speech in Congress, denied the right of the federal government to take over the state militia for war purposes and urged the state governments to resist. Massachusetts and Connecticut had refused to send their militia, and in the same month with Webster's speech, representatives of 5 New England states at the Hartford Convention passed resolutions widely considered treasonable for protesting the tyranny of the federal government. In 1825, William Rawl, an eminent Philadelphia lawyer, published A View of the Constitution, used as a textbook at West Point across Lee's student days. In it, Rawl held, "The states then may wholly withdraw from the Union. The secession of a state from the Union depends on the will of the people of such state." No Southern leader ever claimed more than that. Yet there's a statement of a distinguished Northern authority in a textbook used under government auspices to educate officers for its army. The division of opinion became sectional, partly from economic causes, but chiefly because of slavery. When the war broke, there were 4 white votes in the Union to 1 in the seceding states. This discrepancy was not overcome by allowing 5 slaves to count as 3 white votes in determining national representation. Thus, the South was outvoted in securing protection for Northern industry as against free trade for Southern agriculture. With the growing abolition sentiment of the North, what would happen if slavery were suddenly abolished? The South had the Nat Turner Rebellion in mind, followed by the John Brown Raid, a frank effort to cause the slaves to rebel. Had it succeeded, what would have happened to the women and children of the South? That was the terror in the heart of every thoughtful Southerner, and the South's demand for extension of slave territory was a struggle for self-preservation, not to be completely outvoted in the national councils. That must be recognized to understand the conflict of loyalties that was the Civil War. Lee was earnestly opposed to slavery and deeply attached to the Union, holding that its dissolution would be the worst of calamities, to avoid which he would sacrifice everything but honor. He had further a record of 30 years distinguished service in the Union Army. When he reached Washington, President Lincoln, through Blair, offered him the command-in-chief of the Union forces. Lee declined, of course. He could not imagine leading an army of invasion into his own state against his own people. He went home to Arlington, spending the next night walking to and fro in a room upstairs, while his wife waited anxiously in a room below. The sound of his footfalls ceased only when he knelt in prayer. Toward morning he came down and said to the anxiously waiting wife, "Well, Mary, the question is settled. Here is my resignation and the letter I have written General Scott." April 12th, Fort Sumter had been fired upon. April 15th, Lincoln called for troops. April 17th, Virginia, on the state versus nation issue, seceded, followed by 3 more states. 3 days after his resignation from the Union Army, Lee was offered command of the Virginia Forces for Defense and accepted. So the crucial decision was made, the only one Lee could make, being who he was, and the decision you or I would have made with Lee's inheritance, education, and devotion to duty, as his conscience told him. When the war began, the Union had 22 million white population. The Confederacy, 5.5 million white, 3.5 million black. The North was rich in manufactures. The South had little or none. During the war, the Union enlisted 2.5 million men. The Confederacy, 900,000. That in spite of the seemingly insuperable odds, Lee carried through 3 years of brilliant warfare, winning a series of victories unequaled in history except in the career of Napoleon, makes him one of the great military captains of all time. McClellan, Pope, Burnside, and Hooker in turn went down before Lee's fewer numbers but consummate strategy. After the brilliant victory of Chancellorsville, the South was jubilant, believing the war over. Lee saw more truly that unless he could destroy the Union Army, the inexhaustible resources of the North in men, money, and manufactures meant the war could end only one way. So he planned his second campaign into the North, culminating in the terrible drawn battle of Gettysburg. Having failed to destroy the Union Army, Lee withdrew his shattered troops, Meade failing to follow. In the spring of 1864, the tide definitely turned with the emergence of Grant, called by Lincoln from his Western victories to the Supreme Command. Grant was then 42, Lee 57. Both were men of military genius. Lee far the greater strategist, with more brilliant military imagination. Grant with dogged determination and indomitable will. Grant leading 120,000 well-provisioned and equipped troops. Lee some 65,000, ragged, starving, but dauntless. Behind Grant, the rich resources of the Union. An exhausted Southland behind Lee. Grant moved south. There followed those days in the wilderness with sickening Union losses. But defeated, Grant moved forward. That won the war. Grant blundered repeatedly. His losses during the campaign were greater than Lee's entire army. But steady hammering wore away the granite rock of Lee's resistance. By 1865, his army had dwindled to 30,000, and there were no more to be called. So he made his humane decision, accepting Grant's generous terms, and on April 9th surrendered his still dauntless army. Those 30,000 Confederate soldiers immediately fraternized with Union troops and ate the first good meal they had known for months on the ample Union rations. Soldiers do not hate. Big men do not hate. It is little men who stay at home and elaborate their hooded viper poison who hate. Lee returned to Richmond, welcomed as hero. And soon a grand jury in Norfolk indicted him for treason. Grant, indignant at this violation of his terms of surrender, caused the indictment to be quashed. Lee then applied for pardon under the Amnesty Act, sending his papers to Grant, who laid them before Congress. No notice was taken of them. And to the shame of the North be it said, Lee died 5 years later, a prisoner on parole. Numerous offers of employment were made him. One firm is said to have offered $50,000 just for the use of his name. He replied, "Well, if my name is so valuable, I would better be careful how it is used," and refused. Would there were more like him in the land. He declined the rectorship of the University of Virginia, the presidency of the University of the South, refused to run for the governorship of Virginia. Finally, the trustees of Little Washington College at Lexington, Virginia, now appropriately Washington and Lee University, asked him to be their president. It seemed humble enough even for Lee's modesty. He accepted on condition that he could fulfill the duty of every citizen to aid in the restoration of peace and harmony and in no way to oppose the policy of the state or general governments directed to that object. So Lee spent the last 5 years of his life educating citizens for our democracy, for our America. In the spring of 1870, he was ill and broken. He went away hoping to get better. Came home and grew rapidly worse. In the last hours, his mind wandered, evidently going over his old battles, for almost his last words were, "Tell Hill he must come up." So October 12, 1870, Lee died, 63 years old. Nature's nobleman he was, of spotless personal life, obeying duty in every act of his conduct, the greatest military leader of the Anglo-Saxon race, not accepting George Washington and the Duke of Wellington, loved by his own people with a devotion given to no other American, incarnating all that was best in that beautiful, passionate, and loyal Southland, today so precious a part in our united America.
Lee, the American warrior, has been the subject of another program in the series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author. Next week, Dr. Griggs will speak on Lincoln, the prophetic American. Copies of tonight's discussion of Lee, the American warrior, may be obtained by addressing the National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York, or the station to which you are listening. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.